Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Motivational Intelligence Podcast. I'm Sean Johnson, and on this podcast, it's our job to deconstruct for you what makes people and organizations successful. Typically, we do this by interviewing or having conversations with world-class trainers or people who have accomplished extraordinary feats in their field. The episode today is an interview I've been wanting to do for about 3 years now, and I've been trying to get this guy in the studio for about that long, because when Joe Gianni first entered my life about 5 years ago, it was a fundamental shift in how I started to think about the world, how I started to think about myself. He's made me, as a coach and mentor to me, he's made me infinitely more capable and overall just a better person. And I'm not alone in this. He is the silent man behind the scenes to countless rags to riches stories of self-made millionaires and entrepreneurs. So this is going to be a really exciting episode for you to listen to. Just a little quick bio about Joe. He was a top sales producer and sales manager and executive at Macmillan Publishing right out of college. He is actually the founder and CEO of Too Logical. Too Logical is a global leadership and sales training company. He's the author of Swagger, Traits, Techniques, and True Stories from the Movement That's Changing Sales. He's also authored countless articles in major business and trade magazines, as well as training systems that have been implemented by some of the most iconic companies from across the world, about 40% of the Fortune 500. They've been utilized in up to, I believe, 53 countries now. He was actually also a first-line student of some of the leaders of the fathers of the self-help movement, including Paul J. Meyer and W. Clement Stone. So this is an interview that I think you'll really enjoy, and we're going to try to hook him back in here for a part two. In part one, we cover some of his early story, and in part two, we're going to cover some of his management and leadership techniques. So until next time, please enjoy this episode of the Motivational Intelligence Podcast. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this, and feel free to reach out to us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, all those good places, and share this with anybody you think would find it valuable.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at Too Logical. Too Logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. Too Logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with: Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs or just want to say hey, head over to TooLogical.com.
And so it begins. I am I'm really excited. Today we got the big man in the house. the big boss man. Joe Gianni's our CEO, and I'm really excited to have him. I've probably been trying to get you in a studio for about 3 years now.
Probably.
Yeah.
Hey, well, you know I'm shy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. I'm really excited to chat because Joe has been an incredible life-changing mentor to me, and there's been so many times where we've had a conversation and afterwards I just think, damn, I wish I could have recorded that. So we're going to start doing that.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. So thanks for, I hooked you in, and this hopefully won't be the last time.
I think you could drag me back in.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're going to like it. I think, you know, for this conversation, I just wanted to kind of go through your journey, because there's been a lot of stories that you've told me over the years, and a lot of lessons that you've passed on that come from your journey to, you know, from Long Island all the way to where we are today. And so that's kind of what I was thinking for our chat today. So where'd you grow up? Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I originally grew up in Long Island, New York, in a little town called East Islip, my entire childhood. And people say, Joe, how'd you build a global leadership and sales training company out of Rochester, New York? And I always share with people the same thing. I say, blonde-haired, blue-eyed lady. So I met my wife in college, and she was from Rochester, New York, Webster. And when we got engaged in college, and her and I settled here.
Yeah.
So that's the story.
So so talk about your childhood a little bit. So you grew up in East Islip, Long Island. What was that? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, so, I had a magical childhood. It was truly magical. And, I didn't know it at the time growing up. But as the years went on, I realized that, especially as you grow up and you move away and you meet people and all different, paths and walks of life. But it was truly magical. My mother and father, my father was Italian, my mother was Irish, so that made for at times a nice volcanic upbringing, but mm-hmm. they were wonderful people. God bless them, God rest their souls. But they were wonderful peeps, and my dad had his own business, so I used to go to work with him on the weekends. And as a young guy, I said, someday I want to be like my dad. I want to start my own company. And I didn't know the word entrepreneur back then. So that's
where it all started.
Yeah. It's kind of, that lit the fire. But I had a very, very close knit group of friends from the neighborhood that, to this day, we've all stayed extraordinarily close. And as I said, it was really magical.
Yeah.
Lots and lots and lots of positives. And that's not, of course, everybody's, story and upbringing.
Yeah. So talk about your parents a little. What kind of business did your dad have?
Yeah, so my dad had an oil service business. He was the youngest of four brothers. He was second generation. My grandparents were first generation. And one of his brothers had an idea to start this oil service business. And, basically in Long Island, houses aren't heated with gas, especially back then. They were all oil. So him and one of the other brothers, bought some trucks and started buying and selling oil and fixing things. And then my dad was in the electronics business, but he was the final son to join the business. My grandparents said to the three other brothers, Tommy's ready to come into the business now. So, you bring him in, he gets 25%. That's just how it worked.
That's just how it was.
There's no questions asked. And they did that for a bunch of years, and it was a great business. You get to see a lot growing up in a family business. Even though my father didn't bring that home, the good or the bad, the ups and the downs on a regular basis, but we were very tight. We were very tight with my cousins and my aunts and uncles, and it was magical, really.
Yeah. What was it like going to work? You said you used to go to work with your dad a little bit.
Yeah, so it was kind of neat, in the summertime, because, again, there was an oil service business, so there was no real air conditioning I don't even think there was anything back then, yeah. Or if it was, just barely. Because we're talking in the late 60s, early 70s, probably in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. So I'd go there in the summer months where I was, had a lot of time. I'd get there and my uncles would be fixing lawnmowers. So they would just fix lawnmowers in the summertime, they'd wheel them out. And it was kind of fun. But it was always great to go because I'd get to see my uncles.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, so seeing your dad and your uncles with that business is kind of where the entrepreneurial bug bit you a little bit, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, it stung me. It didn't bite me. It stung me hard. Yeah. And again, I was really young too. I was like 10 years old, but it was interesting because, I came home and, I said to one of my other childhood best friends, I said, someday I'm going to start my own business. And he said, great, I'll do it with you. So he and I used to talk about it all the time. It was very uncommon, really, looking back. I didn't realize it at the time. But when we were 15 years old, he and I started our first business together. It was digging clams in the Great South Bay. Because back in that period of time, clamming was a huge, the Great South Bay was a huge resource of clams. And young guys and gals, but it was mostly guys, would get boats and literally go out all through the summer and dig clams. We made quite a bit of money. In fact, we made a lot of money doing that as 15, 16, 17. We did it all the way through college. But it was great because, he and I had our own business together, and we loved every second of it. And, you know, we'd dig clams all day and work real hard, and then we'd come back to shore, and we learned how to negotiate with the folks that were buying the big commercial guys would be on the shore waiting for us, all the boaters to come in, and we'd negotiate. It was magical.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's very cool. So that was, you were about 15 when you.
Yeah, I was
that.
15. Yeah, 15, and then when I turned 16, I got a job in a grocery store, and so used to do that through the. I did it all through the summer because I didn't want to lose the job, but in the winters it was great too, and. And then when I'd come home from school, they'd always take me back in. So I was pretty driven young guy.
Yeah. What was it like as a 15-year-old kid, starting to try to negotiate with, the buyers that you're coming in, you're a kid at that point.
Yeah.
And these are, I'm assuming, like probably grown men,
yeah.
Coming in. What was that? What was it like negotiating with
them? Yeah. Well, it was interesting because, partially, I've always been an observer of people, again, I didn't realize it, but so, we would stand there and we would just watch other people and the buyer would say, well, I'll give you, $40 for the count. And the person said, well, I 45. And, mm-hmm. Sometimes the buyer would do it and sometimes they wouldn't. And that's when we started realizing supply and demand.
Mm.
And, again, couldn't have called it supply and demand back then.
Yeah.
But we just began kind of to realize there were times instinct. Where they would pay up and other times where they wouldn't.
Yeah.
But if you didn't ask, you didn't
right.
get. So
yeah.
So that was really the beginnings of that. And once we realized that, that's how it's played, we started doing it every single time.
Yeah.
And again, sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. But it was great because sometimes we'd push the edge of the envelope. Sometimes yeah. we'd ask, say, what do you think we should ask? The count's at, 55. They'd have a sign up.
Okay.
And the count was 500 clams. And they'd say, well, let's go in at 65 this time and see what they do. And sometimes they'd laugh at us. But the other thing that was interesting was, there wouldn't be like one buyer. There'd be like five trucks backed up, air-conditioned trucks looking to buy the clams. So, at first, we thought, well, maybe we could, go from one to the next to the next. But what we found was it was better to build a relationship. We really began to bond with one of the particular buyers. And, they knew they could count on us. The other thing that was kind of, crazy is that, there were a lot of teenage kids that, would, get boats and clam. Long Island, and especially on the Great South Bay, was a big fishing community. But a lot of people, they wouldn't, they'd go out and say they were clamming, but they'd go over to Fire Island and, spend the day playing. And we never did. In fact, we laugh about it now, all these years later. I think of that entire time, whatever it was, six years of clamming. That entire time we went to the beach twice. So we were workers. So the buyer that we began to bond with began to realize, even though we were very young, we showed up all the time, and good weather, bad weather. I mean, unless it was really bad, but that gave us a lot of negotiating power too, because we were consistent.
Yeah.
And he knew he was getting good clams.
Right.
So that was a really cool thing.
So what do you think it was, where did it come from where, you and your friend are, you went to the beach twice over that whole period of time, and most, 15, 16-year-old kids going out, into the Great South Bay, to say they're clamming, and maybe they do some clamming, but, they're hanging out, and they're just hanging on the water, they're going to the beach, but you didn't really do it that way. What do you think, what made you so driven? Why were you... You and your friend consistently just, bulldogs with it, whereas most people wouldn't be.
It's interesting. There's probably, some pretty obvious things that I'm sure would be common to our listeners. One is, my parents were workers. They worked mm-hmm. hard. My father worked very hard. My mom was a stay-at-home mom when I was really young, but as I got older, she went to work too. And my friends, my one best friend I'm talking about, His father was a really hard worker. His mom passed away when we were very young. So so the father not only worked hard working, but, you know, worked hard taking care of his family. So, you know, we just had a tremendous work ethic. And I think the other big thing, too, because it wasn't even just he and I, it was my whole circle of friends. We were all just workers. And I think it was because we were also all dreamers. You know, as I said, you know, right out of the gate, it was a magical childhood, but there were a lot of underpinnings to that as to why. And, you know, one of them was that, you know, I look back on it all the time, and we just were dreamers. So we always dreamt about, it's not like we were, you know, lacking. We were very much middle income, you know, America. But all of us were big thinking, and all of us had great ambition to, you know, go out and achieve, you know, a lot of financial success, a lot of life success. Yeah. And even though, again, at 15 years old, we could never have articulated it that way, we were all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So I definitely want to come to, because you mentioned that, you know, it wasn't just you and your friend. Mm-hmm. What was your friend's name? John?
John.
So it wasn't just you and John, but you had a broader circle of friends. I want to come back to that. But before going there, the other thing you mentioned was that you picked up on as you were clamming, you know, you started to build a relationship with one of the buyers in particular. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from? You know, because, you know, just looking at it like, we could play, you know, one against the other. And so where did this kind of, it seemed like intuitive instinct to build a relationship with somebody come from? Was that your mom? Was that, where did that come from?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. It definitely came from my family upbringing. You know, my, pardon me, my family was very, very tight knit, but not just with our immediate family, also our extended family. And my mom and dad were very special people, as I said. And, you know, and when any of our family members were struggling, my parents, a lot of times they'd come and they'd say, you know, let's let Aunt Gladys, you know, mm-hmm. set them straight. And they, you know, so there were many, many times in my childhood where, you know, because I was the youngest of all my cousins, mm-hmm. and where, you know, my cousins would move in for like 3 months, 2 months, a year. And you know, together my mom and dad would, you know, kind of set them out straight. And so I think it was watching that. It was watching, you know, aunts and uncles, you know, again, and this was back in those generations where, you know, people really truly watched out for each other and they really helped each other. And that still exists today too, for sure. But it was, so it wasn't even just the cousins, like, you know, if an aunt or an uncle were having challenges, you know, my parents would just take them in. And so it was always, I was always raised that people matter, that relationships matter. And so I think it's a big reason why my childhood friends are still to this day the best friends that I have ever had, you know, and we're all extraordinarily tight. And then same thing, it carried on, you know, not only in the early stages of business, but it carried on throughout all of the business. You know, obviously, you know, Too Logical, you know, we have so many clients and relationships with people that are, you know, not 5 years or 10 years, you know, we're talking 20, 25 plus 30 years of people who I've personally coached and mentored for 25 years, major corporations that have retained us for, you know, in excess of a decade. And, you know, in the training and development business, that in and of itself is extraordinarily unique. So I've always recognized the value of people, and I was always taught indirectly. It wasn't like a sit down at the dinner table, like, yeah, this is lesson on people skills. It was just more
leadership by example.
Yeah, just by watching and observing without even realizing that I was observing that, that people matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's circle back around to you mentioned you and John, you know, there was a broader group of friends that were all dreamers. Who were those people and what do you mean by dreamers?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I had, you know, one of my friends, he tried to clam, but he couldn't clam. So, you know, he went into the carnival business, as crazy as it is. But he made a ton of money, and he was very, very successful at literally building, helping a gentleman build a carnival business. So, again, this is back in the 70s in Long Island, New York. And if anybody's, you know, listening is from Long Island, you know, they're still to this day major travel carnivals. So, you know, so he chased that ambition and then eventually, you know, started his own carnival business when he was like in his 20s and, you know, became extraordinarily successful through all these decades in that industry. So,
yeah.
and a real presence in that industry. So, my one and only claim to fame was, my other neighbor and lifelong childhood best friend was a gentleman named Norman Julius Esiason, right, mm-hmm. who most of the listeners probably recognize, grew up and became Boomer Esiason. Boomer had a dream since we were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old that, you know, he was going to become an NFL quarterback. And when you're kids and you're, you know, with your posse, we would just talk about what we were going to do. And was crazy because, you know, we all, you know, reinforced each other. You know, I remember, by the time we were probably 12, 13, 14 years old, I mean, every single one of us believed that Boomer was going to be an NFL quarterback. I mean,
just no questions.
He didn't have any doubts. And that's what I mean. That's what made it really magical, a huge part of it.
Yeah.
That entire environment, the support, even Boomer's dad, you know, and the other, you know, parents, just always supportive of us as kids, like really overwhelmingly supportive. But, you know, but it was also, you know, back in those days, you didn't necessarily, you know, I think parents spend even more time with their children now than they did back then. But every interaction was always uplifting and positive.
Yeah. So what do you think it was about, you mentioned that everybody, all your friends just believed that you know, Boomer was going to go on and be an NFL quarterback. And obviously he did that. And it seems like a lot of your other friends did as well. What enabled you guys, or where did it come from that you were so supportive of each other? Was it just, did it build on, one person started and it built on the other? How did that kind of, I guess, for lack of a better word, culture in that tight-knit group of friends start or sustain?
You know, it's interesting, as you asked me that question, I've never thought about it from that perspective. I think it was just an innate respect that we had, even as young kids,
yeah.
For each other. It wasn't just me, it was all of us. I mean, like any kids growing up, I mean, heck, we fought with each other,
yeah.
You know, we nicknamed each other, you know, yeah. we did all the harassing and everything else. But but when push came to shove, there was always a tremendous amount of respect there. Again, underlying, you know, if I was 12 years old, I would have never, those words never would have come out of my mouth. But, you know, looking back at it, there was a real healthy dose of respect.
Yeah.
And I think that was a huge part of it.
Yeah. So for, for Boomer in particular, where do you think the confidence for him? And it sounds like that confidence, and maybe it started with him or maybe it started with somebody else, but that confidence was kind of contagious in your group of friends. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, again, as I shared, I think a lot of that, if not all of that, centers in the beginnings of their homes.
Yeah.
You know, in Boomer's case, first off, his dad, Mr. Esiason, whose name also was Norman, but we always affectionately called him Mr. E. In fact, we never, ever said anything. We always said, hey, Mr. E, how are you?
Yeah.
But, you know, Mr. E was extraordinarily supportive of his children. And he was a single dad. A lot of people don't know, but Boomer's mom passed away also when we were young in our childhood. And so his dad really made his three children. Boomer has two older sisters. And he really made them his life. He worked every day, worked in the city. He would take the train every day in, every day out. But he always made time to be with his kids and specifically with Boomer, too. And it's interesting, too. Like, a lot of people don't really know that Boomer's real name is Norman after his dad. But that's because when he was in his mother's womb, he used to come home, Mr. E used to come home and say, Hey, how's my little Boomer doing? Because that's what they always called kickers, you know, in the NFL back then. And so the whole family, aunts, uncles, everybody, he'd always say, how's my little Boomer doing?
Yeah.
So when he was born, everybody just called him Boomer, you
yeah.
know. And, you know, and so I think that, you know, his father was also an extraordinarily good athlete, but had broken his knee, I think, or something. He okay. always limped, but big guy, big towering guy like Boomer is, physically yeah. big guy. But he was always very supportive, but never pushing, but, you know, just always supportive. So Boomer wanted to play basketball, he played basketball. He wanted to play football, he played football. He played baseball, he played baseball. And, you know, and I think that that nurturing and that support, again, that he got in those early stages, I know for a fact, you know, it lit the fire. It stoked the belief and the confidence that, you know, he could go where he wanted to go. And he did just that.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, he kind of struck a balance between building confidence and being supportive, but not pushing.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of that? How did he do that?
Well, yeah. Well, one of the best things, the greatest example is the fact that Boomer's dad always really wanted Boomer to be a baseball player. He wanted him to be a pitcher.
Really?
Yeah. I remember us going to a carnival, right? Yeah. It wasn't even JoJo's Carnival at the time, but yeah. I don't think it was. It might have been, though. We were all teenagers by then.
Yeah.
It might have actually been JoJo's Carnival, but we're walking along what they call the, what do they call that? The fairway, whatever it's, okay. you know, we're walking along where all the games are and everything.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And a guy had one of those radar things set up where you could, you know, throw a ball.
Yeah.
And Boomer took the ball and threw it, and the guy literally, you know, you got like one throw, whatever, and he won like a stuff if you got it over like 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, Boomer was a teenager, and I think he threw it like, you know, 87 miles or something like that.
Yeah.
And the guy literally tapped the machine, said, no, you got to throw that again. That's not right.
Yeah,
that's and he
broken.
Threw it again, you know. So, you know, and Boomer's left-handed.
Yeah.
So, you know, his dad always wanted him to be a baseball player, and he would say, because, you know, look, they have longer careers, you know, there's yeah. not the risk of injury. Da,
yeah,
da.
Sure.
But Boomer used to always say, you know, nah, Dad, I want to be an NFL quarterback. And yeah. And his father, you know, said, well, you know, you can do anything you put your mind to. And that's what you want. You know, that's what it will be.
So that was a message that you heard him say.
It was an overwhelming theme. You
yeah.
know? Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you learn from... You know, from because that's a unique situation to have been so close to, and you're still very close to Boomer, but to have seen kind of from the beginning of, you know, this little kid in this neighborhood in Long Island to go all the way to, you know, NFL, you know, high school football star, college football star, NFL quarterback, NFL MVP, you know, make it all the way to the Super Bowl.
Should have won that Super Bowl.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go there, but and I'm sure he says the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a unique experience for and a unique perspective to be able to have, to see somebody go from, you know, little kid all the way to that. What did you witness in that journey? What did you learn just watching Boomer in that journey from, I'm just a kid that loves playing football, and I said I have a dream of being an NFL quarterback, to actually achieving that. What did you learn in just watching him along that way?
Yeah. So, you know, there are many, I mean, so many inflection points, so many fond memories and things that I watched. And it's funny, as I noticed myself keep saying, at the time, I didn't realize what I was watching. It was years later that I realized what I was watching,
yeah.
like the support of family members, not just my family, but other families. And then when we'd all be together, we're always supportive. But it was there were, you know, many different examples. One was, you know, and I have this flash often when people ask me questions about Boomer and our upbringing. But I remember one night we were at a night game, and we were in high school. And I watched him in that game, and it was just so evident at that period of time that he was significantly more athletic than anybody else on the field. But, you know, people think that, you know, that was because, you know, we're born like that. But, you know, I watched him play and played sports with him every single day of our childhood.
Yeah.
Every single day we played sports. That's what we did. Every single day. Yeah. We played hockey, we played basketball, we played baseball, and we played football, and it was nonstop. We'd play on the streets, we'd walk to a field, we'd find our own ponds to play on, to ice skate on. I mean, we would literally get up to go play hockey, and it'd be 5:30, 6 in the morning, and getting pebbles thrown at my window because half of the guys that, you know, that we grew up with would be out there already. Yeah. Then we'd go to the next guy's house. And, you know, my buddy Jojo that I was telling about that did the carnival business, he lived on the first floor. So, and, you know, we literally tap. Sometimes we would just walk in and get him. So, you know, it was wild, you know, that whole journey. But I think that, you know, so, the, you know, there were things like that where you really start to see it. I went to, you know, obviously when Boomer became a Terp, I used to go down, you know, several times every single season to games and then, you know, ultimately into the NFL. You know, one of the fondest but also most significant memories was when he first went to Maryland, and I came down and we met at a local tavern, and we were sitting in the bar and we were having a beer, and we're kind of doing what teenage boys do. You know, we're just rapping back and forth and the intensity, and we're just talking about how, you know, what it's like in school and what he's experiencing, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, one of the kids from our high school came over and said, "Hey guys, how you doing?" You know, and said, "Hey, you know, doing great." You know, and the guy looks at Boomer and goes, "Hey Boomer," goes, "you still have that, that dream about playing in the NFL and being a quarterback in the NFL?" And Boomer looks up at the guy, and because we're sitting, and the guy says, Boomer says, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I do." He goes, "I don't know if you know, I got a full scholarship to play in Maryland." And the guy goes, "Oh, no kidding." He goes, "Hey," he goes, "you know," he goes, "that's kind of cool." He goes, "but, you know, I got to tell you, you know, only one in a million ever make it, you know, to the NFL." And Boomer says, "Yeah, that's funny." And he kind of, you know, looks back at me and he starts talking to me. And kid goes, "Nah," he goes, "you know, I'm just trying to tell you that, it's such a long shot." And, Boomer looks at him and says, "Yeah," he goes, "why don't you just take your beer and leave?" And the kid goes, "you don't have to get upset with me." And, you know, Boomer's very calm. And he goes, "you know, you're left-handed." He goes, "most of the quarterbacks are right-handed." And he says, "and plus, you know, you're not as fast out of the pocket, you know." And all of a sudden, Boomer just looks at this guy and he just pushes back from the table we're at. And he stands up, and now, you know, he's 6'5", right?
Yeah.
And he looks at the guy and he goes, "hey," he goes, "take your beer and leave now." And the guy, like, takes his beer and wisely, you know, tucks his tail and walks away.
I'm out of here.
So he sits back down, and, you know, and this was, you know, who I was. So I looked at him and I go, "yo, bro," I said, that was a little bit harsh. He goes, "what do you mean, Joey?" You know, and everybody in Long Island, you know, it's either IE or Y, right? Yeah. "What do you mean, Joey?" And I said, "well," I said, "I just think you're a little rude to me." He goes, "no, I wasn't." I go, "I don't know. I think you were." He goes, "no." He goes, "let me ask you a question." I go, "all right, what?" He goes, "in all the years we've been friends, our whole life, he goes, "have you ever said that to me, ever?" I said, "no, of course not." He goes, "how about Jojo and Eddie?" He goes, "have you ever heard them say that to me?" I go, "no, never." He goes, "how about my sisters? Do you ever hear my sisters say that to me?" I go, "no, never." He goes, "how about the football coach in high school? Do you ever hear him say that?" I go, "no, never." He goes, "how about my dad?" He goes, "do you ever hear my dad in our whole childhood growing up together one time ever say that to me?" I go, "no." He goes, "I go, of course not." He goes, "who the hell is he? Who the hell is this guy to tell me what I am and what I'm not, what I'm capable of and what I'm not capable of?" And right there, I looked and I go, "yeah." I go, "you know, you're right." And then we just went on in our, you know, in our rapid discussion of college life.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's one of those inflection points that years later that I realized, looking back, that, you know, he was already conditioned with a mindset and a conviction that, you know, he was not going to be denied, that he was going to pursue and achieve what it is that he wants.
Yeah, and he wasn't going to let anybody else define
Nobody was going to define him. And that's what you and I see in virtually all successful people. Every successful person from every walk of life, whether it's an athlete who rises, or whether it's, you know, people in business that rise, it doesn't really matter. They all have that commonality, a different beat to the drum that they think of themselves, and they think about life through a different lens.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when you and I had first sat down, and I think you you blew my mind for about 4 hours the first time we sat down. But I remember after that conversation of you know, kind of bringing up that point, it's one of those things that you can't unsee. afterwards, you start to see it everywhere. I mean, I remember just flipping on the TV and you know, watching interviews with athletes, and you see it there. And you know, going looking at interviews with, you know, big startup guys or people in the business sector, and you see it there. So it was pretty amazing after you had kind of first pointed that out to me how prevalent it was. It's kind of like it's one of those things that's like hidden in plain sight where it's right there, but if you don't really know what you're looking for, you know, it eludes you and it, for so long. But when somebody points it out, it's one of those things that you can't deny. It's
you
just everywhere.
See.
Yeah, you cannot see. It's just everywhere.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
see it everywhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, people who are, you know, obviously I've been a professional trainer and coach for decades, but you know, so you're never going to hear people articulate it potentially the way I'm about to. But you know, my observation through all these years has been that the people who really truly rise, they don't just have passing, glimmering thoughts of hope of what life can be or what they want. They have a complete and utter conviction. They have complete and utter confidence and commitment that, you know, that our Creator doesn't mock us. We don't get thought impulses and visions of the life we want to have and build without also giving the power and the potential to make that happen. As I said, they would never speak that way, but that's truly what it is. You know, they recognize that they have the power to create their life the way they want it to be. And the overwhelming majority of the population and people, they don't really see life through those lenses. And, you know, that's what I mean when I look back in my childhood. You know, I believe I was saying to you just a little while ago that, you know, we just grew up in a very positive environment where we really believed in that we could do what we wanted to do. We could become who we wanted to become, that life really can be what you want it to be. And, you know, and myself and you know, my childhood friends and as well as the scores of people I've met throughout the decades, that's the one big thing you see in common, that they don't just have dreams, but they really believe that they can make them happen. You know, when I used to run, you know, training classes, one of the things that I would say is that, you know, people don't really recognize, but all of us have been given this tremendous gift from the day we're slapped on the butt and we take our first breath, and that's the gift of life. But the very essence of that gift is every one of our ability to create from that day forth. Dogs can't create, elephants can't create, orangutans can't create, but you and I as human beings, we have the power to create. We can envision a life, a future, what we want, and literally stay with that with conviction. And over time, that will manifest, that will become reality. And it doesn't matter if we're a 10-year-old child, 20-year-old young adult, 40-year-old, 60-year-old, doesn't matter. Every single day, every one of us have an opportunity to recreate ourselves and recreate the life that we want. But how do you and I do that? How do people do that if they've never, ever been helped to see through that lens? And I was conditioned at an early age to see through that lens, even though I didn't know that's what was happening. And it was not an orchestrated effort either, I assure you, but it was just that magical childhood where a lot of that, you know, came from. There was so many messaging too. You know, you have me thinking, you know, probably the last thing I want to share, you know, in my childhood, you know, growing up with Boomer was that, I remember when he first got drafted, I was so close to, you know, his family, and his, you know, his dad was such a wonderful man, and, you know, spent a lot of time with us as kids. And but I remember when literally from the day Boomer got drafted, you know, his father said, I'm very proud of you, very excited for you, but don't forget where you came from ever. Don't forget your friends. Don't forget your family. Don't forget where you came from. And, you know, to his honor and credit, Boomer never did, and respect for his dad, he never ever did. So when he went to the Super Bowl, we all went to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, it was the greatest thing. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, just so many, you know, fond memories of that. And to this day, you know, Boomer still is very, very, very loyal and respectful to where he came from. And I think believe very strongly and know that it was because of that upbringing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk. So that's a fairly good recap of your childhood. After once you graduated high school, where'd you go after that?
Yeah, so I mean, I went on to college, and my other childhood friend John and I used to talk about starting a business, and we had no idea what the business was going to be, but we both went on to college, and we decided that I was the one that was the communicative one, and really loved people, so. I would be the sales face and operation of whatever business we were going to start, and he was going to be the tech guy. And back then, so he went to college to become a chemical engineer. And, there were no such thing as cell phones, obviously, back then. So, but this is how possessed we were. We used to actually do cassette tapes and tape about talking about this business that someday we were going to build and together. And we'd send tapes back and forth while we were at college. How's that for possessed?
Yeah, that's not normal.
No, that's really not normal.
No.
But we did that relentlessly. And ultimately, when I came out of school, I was on a mission, and it was to become a master salesperson.
Yeah. So talk about when you came out of school, you had decided that you wanted to start this business. When you were coming out of school, what were you looking for? What were you trying to do? And, because you didn't go right and start that business.
No.
Right out of college.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. So, I intuitively knew that, I needed a mentor. I knew that, even though I came out of, school and I had a degree in marketing, it didn't give me safe passage to be a master salesperson. So I think, again, unlike a lot of folks, looking back at it at the time, I didn't see it quite like this, but the way I'm going to say it. But I was on a mission not to find a job like I think most people come out of school. I was on a mission to find a mentor more than anything else. I wanted someone that could teach me salesmanship at a extreme level. And I was in a rush, as you could imagine, mm-hmm. any 21-year-old would be. And so that was, that was the beginning of my journey. So I would, go on interviews. I moved to Rochester, New York, where I said earlier, where my wife Michelle is from, grew up. And I'd go on interviews, and in the first 5-10 minutes, if the person didn't impress me, I would politely end the interview, and I'd get up and I'd walk out. And it's funny, just saying that out loud, people would say, "Wow, my gosh, you must have been a really cocky 21-year-old." And the truth of the matter was, I really wasn't. I wasn't cocky. What I was extraordinarily goal-directed. I knew that I needed someone that could really, truly take me under their arms, under their wings, so to speak, and really teach me salesmanship. So unlike just, sitting down with somebody and just having them interview me, I would always interview them. And that was pretty interesting because I had moved here with not a whole bunch of money in my checkbook, and I was down to my last $64 of savings when I finally was given a job, given an opportunity. I found that mentor.
Yeah. So how did you flip the interview around? They were interviewing you, but you mentioned that you were interviewing them. What kind of questions were you asking? How were you interviewing them?
Yeah, I had basically real simple questions. I would always say, can you tell me, how did your sales team do? How'd you guys do this year? Obviously I was looking for people that were extremely successful. I would ask them, how did they get into sales? How has their sales track record been through the years? And it was amazing. I'd got a lot of, real mediocre answers, with different, I wouldn't use company names, but, with the different people that I met.
Yeah. So you were looking for somebody that was accomplished
extremely
accomplished in sales. So you mentioned you found that mentor.
Yeah.
There's a story there.
Yeah, there's a big story there, yeah. It changed the trajectory the rest of my life. But, it's amazing how you can meet somebody in your life and they can have that much of an overwhelming impact. I was going through the Sunday paper looking at the ads because that's for – our listeners, that's how it was done back then. Uh-huh. And I'm going through the ads, and my wife, Michelle, says, "Hey, what about this one?" And there was like a boxed ad, and it was for publishing sales. And she goes, what about this one? And I had totally missed the ad. Hmm. And I was scouring the paper, and I was getting a little desperate.
Yeah.
And I said, geez, I didn't even see it. So I cut it out, and you know, like everything, on Monday I started doing whatever they did. If I had to send a resume or make a call. In this case, I made a call, and they'd asked me maybe four or five questions. I said it was a preliminary interview on the phone. I answered like four or five questions. They said, okay, great. Listen, we're running some interviews at the end of the week. Would you come in? And since it was for a territory, the interview was held at, I think it was like the Hyatt out by RIT. I think it was a Hyatt back then.
Okay.
But anyway, so I go to the interview and I walk in and I'm in the lobby and I'm like, you know, Lombardi time. I'm like 15 minutes early. But as I'm looking around, there's like six, seven people in the lobby. And I realized after just sitting there for a while that they're all waiting to go for this interview for Macmillan Publishing Company. That was a company. And so I was like, whoa. So by the time I got up there, it was like an hour behind. So I was fuming, right?
Yeah, because you're an impatient 21-year-old who knows exactly what you're looking for.
An ambition like you can't believe. So I never forget this. So finally, it's my turn, and I go up there, and I knock on the door, and hey, I'm about to, you know, light this guy up, you know, after the nice talk, you know. And the door swings open, and this gentleman reaches his hand out, and he goes, Randy Demick. He goes, pleased to meet you. He shakes my hand, and he says, he literally looks me right in the eyes, goes down to my shoes, comes up to my eyes again, and he goes, please come in. So we walk in and we sit down, and first thing he does is he puts me at tremendous ease and breaks down every single thing in my head. He just says, first and foremost, I'm really, really sorry. You know, I was interviewing a lot of people. I got a little bit behind. Is this still a convenient time, or would you like to reschedule maybe for tomorrow? And he had a very deep, Orson Welles kind of voice. And I looked at him. I'm saying in my inner voice, I'm going, yeah, no, not a chance.
Yeah, okay. I'm already here.
I'm here. I just lost an hour of my life. Okay, waiting for you.
Yeah.
Big guy. I'm not leaving, right?
Yeah.
So I looked at him. I go, no, it's okay. And he goes, all right, very good. He goes, well, you know. So he starts explaining to me exactly how the whole interview is going to go. I'm going to ask you questions about your resume, get a feel for your background. I'm going to ask you things about your schooling, things about, you know, some of the jobs you had through school, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, and then at the end, I'm going to give you a unique opportunity to ask me any questions you might have. And he says, is that okay? And I said, sure, that'd be great. So that's exactly what happened. But from that second he shook my hand to the way we sat down, it was totally different than any other interview I'd gone on up to that point. I just knew there was something different. Again, looking back, you know, at that second, I didn't know what it was that I was feeling, but I just knew.
You were feeling something.
Something was different. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, he turns to me, you know, towards the end, and he says, you know, gee, Joe, do you have any questions for me? And I said, well, yeah, Randy, as a matter of fact, I do. I said, really, I just have one main question. He goes, you know, well, what's that? And I said, could you tell me, how did your sales team do last year? And he just kind of smiles. And I look at him and I go, and he says, we were number one. And he's still smiling. And I go, I go, really? And he goes, yeah. And I go, what are you smiling about? He goes, Joe, you don't understand. He goes, we're number one every year. And I go, whoa.
Jackpot.
Bingo, right? So I go, really? So I go, well, I go, Randy, I go, how the heck do you do that? He goes, it's quite simple. I train my people. And right there, I knew this was the person I was looking for.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And it was crazy because, as fate would have it, there were people coming in into that lobby to be interviewed behind me.
Yeah.
I mean, there was probably five people behind me. When I walked in, I said there were seven ahead of me.
Yeah.
And but that whole time, whatever time it was I was with him, I felt like there was nobody else on the planet. But then he shocks me and he says, Joey says, I'd like to offer you this job. I want you to come work with me.
Sitting right in the room.
Right there. And I was flabbergasted. So needless to say, I said yes.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he ever did with all the other folks that were stacked up out there, but he literally hired me.
Yeah.
And then I was opened up to a world of transformation and development that I couldn't even barely begin to fathom.
So what do you think, you know, upon reflection, and obviously, you know, you're still very close to Randy, sitting in that, you're a 21-year-old kid sitting in that room, there's, you know, a ton of people coming in before you, a ton of people scheduled to come in after you to fill this one slot, and he sits there and offers you the job in the room. What do you think he saw, or why did he do that with you in particular?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously, I know the real reason why that is because, you know, as the years went on, not only being mentored by him as a salesperson, but then I went on to be carefully trained under him as a sales manager and was heavily part of that development, was, you know, heavily involved in recruiting talent. And, you know, one of the things that I realized is that he had set beliefs that he was looking for in people, you know, mm-hmm. and one of the biggest things of all was their drive. Did they believe enough in themselves that they could succeed? And he always would say, do they have that hunger in their eyes? And that's what he was always looking for. And he must have just saw pure starvation.
Yeah.
Because he was, I think he was as captivated by me as I was by him. At least I like to think that.
Yeah.
But he, I did recruit with him many, many times, and he didn't hesitate when he found the person he was after. He was very dialed in, yeah. Very, very strategic. And you know, I wasn't, you know, I joined his team, and it was already a championship team. It was already a peak performing team. In fact, when I went for orientation, you know, a couple weeks later, I flew down to New York City. And I was given the tour of, you know, the company before I went into the orientation. And as I was walking through, the person that was leading me through the building says, oh, you see this marketing manager over here? They said, yeah, they used to work for Randy. I said, oh, no kidding. They said, and you see this marketing manager in this office? I said, yeah. They go, oh, they used to work for Randy. And I said, oh, really? And they go, yeah. And you see this editor in this office? I go, yeah, they used to work for Randy. And, oh, this editor coming down the hall. I said, well, let me guess. They said, yeah, they used to work for Randy. So obviously, you know, and that was my first full day.
Yeah.
And right there, I knew that, you know, I had truly found what I wanted. I found a teacher. So it wasn't just me. It was the way he had this knack to see talent. He just saw people differently than most people. And he was able to pull that, you know, from time to time, because we worked together for 4 years in those early years of my career. You know, he made hiring mistakes too, but when he made them, he would just, he'd fix it immediately. But most of the time they were right. And these people just went on and became tremendously successful.
So you said, you know, he had, you know, sitting in that interview, you asked him how well you do. And he says, we're number one, and we're number one every year. How did he do that? What were the steps that he took? You know, he gave you the answer of, you know, I train my people.
Yeah.
I want to dive into that a little bit more, because it's train my people is, you know, everybody could say that they train their people.
Yeah.
But obviously he was doing something different.
Yeah.
What was he doing?
Yeah. To unpack it, it really was from the, I'll take us back to when he onboarded me. So first off, he was always working the person's mind from the day you started working with him. So, you know, I remember the onboarding, he sits me down and he says, Joe, he says, you know, I want to, you know, share with you a couple of things, set a few expectations and share a few things with you that are really important for our journey. He says, first off, you know, welcome aboard, and I'm really excited to have you here. He said, but I want to make sure that you understand something. He said, I've interviewed between phone interviews and face-to-face interviews in excess of almost 200 people to find you. He said, I'm not hoping you can succeed at this. I'm not wishing you can succeed at this. He said, I know you can succeed at this. He said, but in the first year of us working together, there's going to come a moment in time where you're going to doubt, and every corpuscle in your body is going to tell you to quit. He said, the very first thing I need you to understand is that you must not quit. You must not quit on me, but most important, because of the investment I'm going to make in you. And he said, but most importantly, you must not quit on yourself. And I'm looking at him, he goes, do you understand? I said, yes. He says, very good, because I need your word. I need your word that when that time comes, you will not quit. You will not give up. And I looked him dead square in the eye, and I said, okay, you got it. Never realizing, I'm thinking, yeah, whatever. Because, again, I'm 21 years old, but he was dead serious.
Yeah.
And then he looked at me, and he said, okay, fantastic. He says, the second thing I want you to realize is this. He says, obviously, you know that, you know, you're joining my team. He says, it's a tremendous team, wonderful team. You're going to really enjoy the people here. He said, what I need you to understand more than anything else is that this is a learning culture. He says, I've built a learning culture. And what that means is this. I create a safe environment to teach you your sales and your career. He goes, I'm not just coaching you on sales. I'm coaching you on your career. He says, as you've seen the people in the company who have been promoted, many of them. And not in a cocky way, very humble, but very direct. And he said, but I need you to understand. He goes, what I mean by this is this. He says, I will give you the safe place. I will teach you. I will ask you to try things. He says, you'll make mistakes. He says, I will back you every time you make a mistake. He said, I will back you every single time as you make mistakes. He says, because making mistakes is part of learning. And he said, and I have the utmost patience for learning. I said, okay, great. He says, but once you've shown me and proven to me that you're competent, that you have a skill that you've mastered, that you know how to do something and execute at the highest level, he says, I no longer accept any mistake. He said, it becomes the expectation. He said, you must always operate at that level. He said, because at that point, anything less is no longer making a mistake. He goes, it's incompetence. He says, and I have 100% patience for people learning and growing and making mistakes. I have zero patience for incompetence. Do you understand? I said, yeah, I do. He says, excellent. He said, because the first time I see incompetence, if ever, he says, I'll give you a verbal warning. He says, the second time, I'll put it in writing. And the third time, I'll fire you quicker than shit through a goose. Do you understand? I go, yeah, I guess I do, yeah. But he meant it.
Yeah.
It was such a safe, you know, place. You know, the way that, he taught from the classroom in terms of skill and process, product knowledge, but also in terms of allowing people to make mistakes. And myself and my fellow associates, we made lots of mistakes. But he was always extremely caring and patient on the mistakes. Where he drew the line is if you were incompetent. And everybody who joined that team, they knew that. The other thing was that he painted a vision about being number one. All he did was talk about being number one. This is the number one team in the company. This is the number one team in the industry. And that's all he would talk about, we are number one. When I joined the team, he said, you're joining the number one team, you know. So that's all we ever talked about. And it was the expectation that we were all going to be the best. So, he was brilliant and strategic in terms of the way he taught skill. He was brilliant and strategic the way he taught product knowledge. But he was absolutely brilliant in the way that he shaped people's beliefs and commitments to excellence. At 21 years old, all I cared about was learning how to sell, right? Mm. So I thought it was going to be about, building rapport with people and qualifying and, presenting and closing and, the fundamentals of selling. But ultimately what I realized in being under his tutelage and care was that he was really teaching me and everybody that ever worked with him a philosophy. And that philosophy was, it started and ended with that the greatest sale that any of us were ever going to learn to make in our lives was the sale that we did not try to make to someone else, but the sale that we learned how to make to ourselves to be the best that we could be at whatever role, not just in professionally, but whatever role we would ever take on in our lives. And, that's an easy thing to say. That's a whole nother different class of actually learning that and living that. But he infused that into everybody, all of us. And, you thought about being a better, you know, spouse. You thought about being a better friend. You thought about being a better, you know, parent. I remember having that thinking, and even in those early years, my wife and I, Michelle and I, didn't have any children yet. But I just knew that, you know, I had been schooled a very unique way.
Yeah, so he painted this, he introduced this philosophy of committing to being the best. And it seems like, you know, the first expectation he set with you, he had some foresight with, which was you must commit to not give up. Yeah. Did that ever?
Oh,
yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. That definitely came up. Yeah.
He knew it was coming.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, I mean, you know, he so understood how people think and their the experiences that they were going to have even before they had them, that he would actually set in their minds the inflection point that they were going to come to even before they would come to it. I never realized that people could think like that and think so in advance like that. But that was one of many gifts and skills that he possesses. But it happened about six, seven months into the journey. I'll never forget it. I was my territory was upstate New York, so I don't really want to use the college even. But I was at one of the colleges here, and I was in the business department, and I made a call. Like I was always, you know, sitting with professors, and I knocked on the professor's door, and he was actually the dean of the department, and I knocked on the door. He brought me in, and I sat down, and we started talking, and as I was starting to build rapport, he just kind of looked at me and said, you know, just cut to the chase. And, you know, I was trained to follow a process, and I was disciplined. So, you know, I was polite, and I just kept going. But I was, you know, probably only 6 months in, if that. So obviously I was as green as they get. And probably about 4 minutes into the conversation, the professor just looks at me, and he put his hand up like in a stop motion. And then he stood up. He walked around his desk. He walked past me. He walked to his door. He opened the door. He turned. He looked at me. I'm still sitting in the chair. I'm looking over my shoulder back at the door now. And he took his, you know, index finger, and he kind of scrolled it towards himself, and like as if, come here, mm-hmm. right? So I got up, and I walked towards him, and he stepped out into the hallway, and I stepped out in the hallway, and he went like that. You know, he signaled me to follow him out. I got out in the hallway, and he walked back in his office, and he slammed the door in my face.
He didn't even say anything?
Nothing. That was it.
Ugh.
And I was like, who the hell does this guy think he is? Yeah. You know, I grew up with some pretty big guys. I was, you know, I was in pretty good shape. I'm like, well, maybe I'll just open the door up and, you know, teach him a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I was beside myself. So needless to say, I stormed down the hallway, down to the stairwell.
Probably seeing red.
I was fuming. I was coming unglued. Yeah. By the time I got down the first flight of steps, I was already crying. I was in tears. I was like, how dare someone treat another human being like that? Who does this guy think he is? This is BS. You know, I quit. You know, I walked out to my car. I jump in the car. I started up. I jam the thing in reverse. I squeal in reverse. That's why you never want to buy these, you know, corporate, fleet cars. And, yeah, I rip it into Ford. I'm peeling out. I'm going down the, you know, through the college parking lot the whole time. Literally, you know, crying now. I'm literally crying. And, you know, I can't do this. You know, this wasn't right. This isn't for me. Who the hell would want to be in sales? And then all of a sudden, this voice pops into my head. And I need you to give me your word that you won't quit on me or yourself. And I saw an open spot, as fate would have it. It was the last one in the parking lot. And I wrenched the car into the spot. Turned the car off, wiped the tears off, grabbed my book bag, and walked back in. And I made it my mission to sell every single business professor in that school our books, which I did, by the way.
Did you?
Took a little while, yeah, but every single one of them. So, that's how much he was able to premeditate the journey that people were on when he was teaching and learning for them.
Yeah. So, you know, you also mentioned that you know, he indoctrinated you into this philosophy of being the best, and if you're going to do something, be the best. How did he help you do that?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, again, you know, looking back on it, there was a very much an orchestrated way that he developed people. But, you know, it really started in going into the field with him. You know, obviously, again, he was very strategic, so he taught that in the classroom when we would classroom train. But when we got to a campus, first thing we'd do is we'd have a cup of coffee, we'd sit and we'd go over the game plan. You know, today they call it account management. I don't know what they even called it back then, but we were very carefully mapped out of where we were going, what departments, who we were trying to meet, et cetera. And then we would start, knocking on doors. But the very first day in the field together, actually it was quite a magical day, and it was the beginning of when you say, what did he really do? So he says to me, he says, Joe, I've been looking forward to, you know, getting out of the classroom and now being in the real world and doing our first calls together. He said, today what we're going to do is we're going to do these calls jointly. He says, I'll do the first one. He says, and then we're going to come out and we're going to ask ourselves three questions. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? And most importantly, what can we do to improve? And I said, okay, great. He says, and then after, you know, I do the first interview, he goes, you'll then do the second interview. Then we'll come out, we'll debrief. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? What do we need to do to improve? Then I'll do the third interview. We'll do the same thing and on so forth.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, got it, right? And he goes, you good? I said, yep, good. So we go in and yeah, I watched the first sales call, and it was like watching art right there in motion. I mean, he was phenomenal. The professor, you know, was laughing with him in the rapport stage. He qualified him out. You know, he asked the professor, some closing questions about giving us an opportunity to really review the book and maybe test fly it next semester, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, the professor says, yeah, you know, that'd be great. You know, Randy, yeah, I'd like that. You know, thank you very much for coming in. So I'm just thinking, wow, this is great. You know,
this is how this goes.
Yeah. You know? So we walk out and we sit down and, he made sure we walked out and didn't matter if there was another appointment, schedule that we had to try. He'd stop and we sat down. He said, Joe, he said, you just watched everything we talked about in the classroom. Now you've watching me do it with a live person. He said, "What did I do right? What did I do wrong? And most importantly, how can I improve to make it better, stronger, more capable of getting us to what we're after, the goal of making a sale?"
So he was asking. I mean, you just watched this art in motion that he walks in, he's got this guy laughing,
knew each other their whole life.
Yeah, yeah, he's got the guy laughing. At the end of the sales call, the guy's thanking him for coming in, which if you're in sales, is not always the case.
Yep.
But he's asking that question of, you know, what did I do right, what did I do wrong, what can I do differently or to improve, even after he just nailed that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's exactly where it went. I said, because what did I do right? And I said, well, you know, Randy, it was textbook. I mean, you walked through rapport, you qualified him, you created a great, you know, chasm between where he is, what he's looking to see different. You presented, you know, like a champ, you know, it was phenomenal. And you trial closed him and he committed to take a close look at it, you know, for next semester. And I said, that was our goal. And he says, yeah, he goes, yeah, you know, it, he goes, it did go quite well. He said, what do you think I did wrong? And I said, I don't think you did anything wrong. And he said, well, I think I could have asked this one question slightly different. So I don't know, looking back, if he was just trying to make that up or what, because to me it was perfect. But yeah. And he says, okay, very good. He goes, I'm good to go. He goes, you're up. You ready? I said, yeah, let's go. So, you know, we go down the hallway and we knock on the next door. Professor, you know, says, oh, yeah, what's up? We said, hi, you know, we're with Macmillan Publishing Company. We wonder if we could sit down and chat with you for a little bit. Professor says, sure, come on in. We sit down in the chair. And, of course, you know, I'm looking at Randy and, you know, he's looking at me and I'm looking at the professor. And I'm just figuring, well, you know, if I'm quiet long enough, you know, Randy will start talking. But Randy doesn't do a single thing. He just sits there. And finally I realized, like, oh, he was serious. This is me. You
know, yeah, I'm up.
It's showtime, right?
Yeah.
So, I look at the professor and I'll never forget this as long as I live. I look at this professor and I go, Dr. Jones, just like that. And all of a sudden, every single pore in my body started sweating. I literally started melting right before this professor and Randy's eyes. That's all that came out. And I am just sweating to the point where the professor's kind of leaning up on his chair, looking over the desk like, is he all right? And that was it. I couldn't speak. I couldn't say a word. Nothing, right? So Randy's looking at me and going, So I was like, you know, I looked like the Wizard of Oz, like the Wicked Witch just melting away. Literally, that's what it looked like. And Randy looks, and finally he realizes, like, that's it. That's all the kid's got.
Yeah.
And so he swoops in and takes over the interview and, you know, of course, magic and everything else. You know, and I get the, you know, the drying up sweat, you know, as we wrap up the meeting. And, you know, I look, you know, I shake the professor's hand, thank you, you know, and he's kind of looking at me with his head a little cocked, you know, like a dog when they hear a sound, you know, like a weird noise, you know, like, look at it, is this kid all right? We get up and we walk out the door. And as we get out the door, I go, all right, Randy, you know, we got to go. We got to get to our next meeting. You know, so, you know, it's in the other building, and I'm walking really fast, and he's going, oh, Joe, wait up for a minute. I'm like 4 or 5 steps ahead of him.
Trying,
like,
to get the hell out.
I just was eject, right? Yeah. So he goes, oh, Joe, wait, well, hold on a second. I go, no, come on, Ray, we got to go. And I keep pushing down the hallway. He says, Joe, he goes, oh, yeah, we got to talk for a minute. I go, no, we're going to be late. We got to go. And he goes, Joe, stop. Sit down. He points to this bench, right? You know, a lot of the hallways is benches, right?
Yeah.
He goes, sit down. We need to talk. And I'm like, oh boy. So I'm like figuring, you know, what's he going to say? You know, is your resume up to speed? Have you ever considered a different career? What's he going to say to me, right? Yeah. And we sit down, and I look at him, and I go, yeah, Rand. I go, you know, what's up? And he goes, well, just simply 3 questions. What'd you do right? What'd you do wrong? And most importantly, what can you do differently? What can you refine and reshape so that you're more capable of getting us to our goal, a new sale? And I'm like looking, going, is he kidding? It's like, is he kidding? First off, he's not firing me?
Right.
Yeah, it's my inner voice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm looking at him, and I go, well, I didn't know, you know, I'm like, I'm stuttering. I'm like, So I look at him, I go, you know, Rand, I go, I think I was breathing real well. And all of a sudden, he just looks at me and he goes, exactly. He goes, I've never seen someone suck so much oxygen out of a room like that and then blow it back out. He goes, it was amazing to watch. He goes, in the next interview, I want you to work some words into it. And I looked at him like, that's it? He's like, let's go. We got up and we walked. So, you know, you say, what did he do differently? That was, you know, the beginning of the magic and the way that he trained people. Because, you know, when I look back through those years, I realized that on that first day, he had given me precious gifts of self-development. And those gifts were really 2 things. One was the habit of self-reflection, the habit to really stop and not just do things in life, but to stop and really ask myself on anything that's important, whether it's, you know, learning to sell, whether it's, you know, learning to drive a car, whether it's learning to be a better friend, whether it's learning to be a better husband, whether it's learning to be a better father. It was the habit of reflection. And that was that first gift. Most people just seem unconsciously going through life, right?
Yeah.
But that's not how he was conditioning me to think and see things. So that was that first gift. But the second gift was every bit as priceless. The second gift that he gave me and anybody that he trained, because he trained everybody the same way in the field, was the ability to basically protect myself from the overwhelming negative feedback that each of us gets anytime we're learning something new. And for any listeners, you know, right now that are in sales, I mean, in the early stages, you know, that's not an uncommon story. You know, everybody has their story. And but that is a 100% true story. It's exactly what happened. But what was so different was he, by him, one, helping me to learn to stop and reflect, but two, to ask those 3 questions, magical questions. He began to help me to protect myself, to not judge myself based upon the mistakes I was going to make, but to learn from those mistakes. So that's why those 3 questions are magical. What did you do right? What did you do wrong? And most importantly, what did you learn? How can you adjust this? And, you know, and it enables people to, you know, be free to realize that, you know, I'm going to learn something new, no matter what it is. You know, I'm going to have a conversation with my child and it doesn't go well. Well, a lot of people start thinking, well, I'm just not good communicating with this kid, or, you know, but rather than saying, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? What did I learn? And adjusting. He was helping me from that day to begin to think differently about everything, just in that first day of being in the field together. So when you say, what did he do differently? He taught in the classroom skills. He's taught in the classroom process. He taught in the classroom product knowledge. We were selling college books in every department you can name. So one hour we'd be talking about chemistry, another hour we'd be talking philosophy or sociology, another hour later we'd be talking to engineering or to mathematics. Think about the scope of the knowledge. Yeah. But he had a very special way that he taught people how to learn industry knowledge, product knowledge. But most importantly, he gave people the combination to learn about themselves. And that was the beginning of that formula.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is, maybe we do it in a part two, because I think it's worth doing if I can hook you back into here.
Yep.
I'd like to kind of peel back the curtain of a little bit more with the way Randy was developing you, because he was doing a lot of things behind the scenes that, as you mentioned, you weren't really aware of at the time necessarily, or why he was doing certain things. But he was doing everything in a very strategic way, and I'd like to dive into that maybe in a part two if we can hook you back before we wrap up with this one. Is there any kind of final thoughts or anything about, you know, our conversation today that you would want just people to take away with?
Well, you know, I think first off, I thank you for dragging me in and finally.
Took 3 years, but we got you, baby.
That's it. Yeah. But you know, it's been a great conversation, because it's really caused me to be reflective, and in that reflection, realize that none of us walk alone. That, you know, I stand on the shoulders of giants from early upbringing of strong parents to lifelong friends to my mentor meeting right out of college to even different college professors, even, you know, some of the high school teachers we all have had. And, you know, the conversation has really gotten me to slow down and realize how important it is to be thankful for these special people, because these different people, I've come to realize through the decades, but, you know, to share with everybody and yourself is that these people committed to excellence in their roles. And I was such a tremendous beneficiary of that. So I think the first thing is to share with everybody the appreciation for when you and I are in the presence of greatness. And greatness comes in all different shapes and forms and all different roles in life. Great parent, a great friend, a great manager, a great professor. And to recognize that and appreciate that. And I think the other big thing, slowing down and talking about it is how important it is to help people understand that, you know, our Creator doesn't mock us. We don't get thought impulses. We don't get ideas and visions of what we want to do, what we want to have, who we want to become, without also not being given the abilities, the innate abilities inside of us to actually live that life, become that person, and have the life that we want to have. Because I sure have, and the people that, you know, I've trained and mentored closely sure have had, and the people I grew up with sure have had. And I think that's important, because I think that's an important beginning of that journey, not just for me, but for anybody I've ever worked with, coached. That ability or that understanding that we all have that ability to envision what it is that we want and to begin to make that happen. And the, you know, maybe the final thing is the importance of recognizing the need to, when it comes to getting what we want out of life, it won't happen because simply we dream it or envision or wish for it, but because we commit to excellence, we commit to being the best that we can be, and that we have, all of us have the ability to travel that path of reflection. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? What did we learn? And actually learn from our mistakes, not judge ourselves from our mistakes. That's easy. But to really learn from those mistakes and become stronger and better so that one day we can actually have the life we really want to have.
It's a pretty good way to end it.
Well, thanks again.
All right, thanks. Hey guys, one more thing before you take off. This is Motivational Intelligence Insider. It's just a very short, exclusive email every Monday that comes from Dave, John, and the guests on this show. This is the only place they share their very, very best stuff, and it's delivered right to your inbox every single Monday. This could include exclusive tips for upping your game, articles they're reading, videos they're watching, stories from the road, and on and on. It's the best way to kick off your week, and this content is comes directly from Dave, John, and the guests, and is only available to subscribers of Motivational Intelligence Insider. So if you want these guys and gals to email you their best stuff, go to twological.com/insider. That's the number 2logical.com/insider, and drop in your email. And if you do, I hope you enjoy.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is produced by the team at 2Logical. 2Logical is an international corporate training firm and the world's leading expert in motivational intelligence, which is the ability to understand, manage, and change the motives people have. 2Logical offers over 30 different keynotes, workshops, and full training courses to small, medium, and large Fortune 500 companies in 53 countries, a lot of which you're probably familiar with: Pfizer, Bank of America, GE, Constellation Brands, P&G, and more. All solutions are completely customized, and the feedback from these sessions will blow your mind. If you have any training or speaking needs or just want to say hey, head over to 2logical.com.